Hi. Sorry, guys. Brian was supposed to write an intro for this particular episode of Junk Food Cinema, but McDonald's is no longer serving the McRib, and he's in existential crisis.
Who am I here?
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome to Junk Food Cinema here on Film School Rejects. This is the podcast that is always long on appreciation and short on wit. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I am joined, as always, by my friend and co-pilot, screenwriter slash novelist, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Happy New Year!
Not yet. Close.
Shit.
Very close, but not quite yet.
What holiday are we doing this week?
Ah, that remains to be seen. Before we get into that, I want to remind you that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And we will have a link to whatever this mystery movie is that you've probably already seen in the title of the episode on Film School Rejects. It's not the point. The point is, when you want to buy that title, you can actually use a link right here on the webpage, and that actually will benefit us, and we really do appreciate that. If this is your first taste of Junk Food Cinema, let me fill you in on what's going on here. All this month, we're celebrating our favorite holiday-based horror films, leaving a rosy trail of blood all across the calendar. Now, you may be thinking, well, it's Christmas time, so they must only be talking about Christmas horror films. No, actually.
No, because everybody else is talking about all the Christmas horror films.
And when we get to our Christmas episode, which is actually next week, we're doing something really irresponsibly nerdy. Possibly irresponsibly nerdy, I think, is maybe
possibly
the best.
Irresponsible. Possibly. I mean, we are film critics.
Are we?
Who we have been at periods of time. I was able to write that on a couple of tax forms.
Hey-o.
But we have been film critics who are going to do an episode, talk about something at Christmas, and not talk about Black Christmas.
I know, right? No.
I mean, name a horror blogger on the planet that hasn't written the Black Christmas article.
Yeah.
We all had to fucking write it at one point. We're not talking about Black Christmas.
As much as I love talking about Black Christmas, I feel like I've done
and
that.
And you That's, do.
And I do.
You loved the remake.
Fuck you.
He did not love the remake.
No, I did not love the remake. But this tangent aside, last week we made it as far as Valentine's Day on the calendar and talked about My Bloody Valentine. Today we leap forward to the third Sunday in June. That's right, we're celebrating Father's Day here at Junk Food Cinema with a little flick called The Stepfather.
Which actually is not a holiday film.
It's such a fucking cheat. We're cheating in week two. We're terrible people. This is just like when you make your New Year's resolution to lose weight, you're going to go on a diet, and by week two you've cheated. That's exactly what happened here. But you know what? I have no regrets.
There's no really good Father's Day movie. There
not
is
really.
A Father's Day movie, but there's no really good Father's
there,
Day.
There was, yeah, I didn't actually see the one. Was it Astron 6 that put it out? I didn't actually see that one, but this film, I tell you what, it is a bit of a cheat, as this movie doesn't take place on Father's Day, but if ever a horror film made you reconsider sending that Hallmark card and necktie to dear old dad, it's The Stepfather.
Oh, that guy in Bellevue that killed his whole family. Cut him up with knives. Maybe they disappointed him.
He scares me, Dr. Bondurant.
All we need is a mortar out here.
The Stepfather.
Here's the basic premise. This lonely divorcee meets a wonderful guy named Jerry Blake, and she has a daughter and thinks, you know what, I think it's time that we come together as a family again and complete the family unit. So she decides to marry Jerry Blake. And
all off screen. Like, everything you've just mentioned happens off screen.
No, this is after the thing that you're thinking of. This is what happens after that thing. Oh, wait, no. What are you talking about? No, I know what you mean.
Yeah, no, everything you just said doesn't actually happen in the movie.
Right, it's all
mentioned in backstory.
Right, which is what I'm giving them right now.
Yes, yes. No, get to the part where we flash back off the island.
We flash. God damn it. Will you let me use my own fucking legs here?
Is a flashback from the island before John Locke ends up on the island and ends up going off doing what John Locke does, right? That's the only way this fucking makes sense.
Yeah. No, totally. That's what's going on here.
It's Terry O'Quinn with hair, meaning it's before the island.
No, it's long before the island. This was made in 1987. So
that's how genius J.J. Abrams is.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Can podcasts have lens flares? I feel like we need a few lens flares on this podcast. Can we do an audio lens flare? There you go. Yep, there it is. Thank you for listening to this show. So Jerry Blake, as we go through, you never do that. As we go through the movie, we find out that there's more to Jerry Blake. Well, actually, frankly, we know that frame one.
The movie opens up with Jerry Blake having just butchered his fucking family.
I don't even know why I bothered to do these plot synopses.
Stripping naked, you see John Locke's dong just hanging in the breeze. He takes a shower, and then
I think his name is John Cock at that point.
We get to see all the carnage he has wrought before he goes to start his new life.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is this movie, the very first scene has... You know, it is this moment, as Cargill said, where he's slowly just kind of, you know, he goes in the shower, he comes out, and he's got this beard, and he starts taking it off, and you realize he's transforming himself very slowly, and he looks completely different by the end of it, and he casually starts walking down the stairs, he's whistling Camp Town Races, seems like he doesn't have a care in the world, and at the bottom of the stairs, the camera pulls out from a close-up to a wide shot, and you see the most... jaw-dropping carnage. It's very bold, very upsetting, and it's just like he walks right out the door and just leaves it. It's an entire family that's been butchered, just laying all over the living room.
His family.
And he just walks out, and that's the opening shot of the fucking movie. And from there,
the next
time we see him, he's already, you know, married to this other woman with a daughter. And that, to me, is what's so great about this movie is, like, they let the audience in immediately on who this guy is. They tell you everything. It's like a Hitchcock film. They tell the audience more than they tell the characters.
Yeah.
So we're spending the entire movie in suspense, knowing that at any moment, this fucking psychopath is going to erupt and probably take out these people. And we're screaming at them, you know, just completely impotently screaming at them, like, no, he's terrible. But what's great about Terry O'Quinn, who... is cast, you know, from what we know about him on Lost, this is going to feel, you know, fans of Lost are going to feel like this is a very against type piece of casting.
No.
Because he is absolutely, he walks this beautifully fine line between being absolutely crazy and impossibly charming.
Well, and that was exactly what got him fucking Lost. It's exactly what got him great, you know, great bits throughout his career. Terry O'Quinn, until Lost, was one of those great character actors that nobody really knew.
Right.
That you know, nobody did recognize. In fact, I was watching this movie earlier today with my wife, and she came in and she sitting there, and I'm like, "You recognize him?" And she's just like, "No." and then she's like, "Wait, he seems kind of familiar." I'm like, "He seems really familiar, doesn't he?" And she's like, "Yeah," and I just can't place him. And it's like, "Yeah, because this is an island flashback." And she's like, "It's an island flash. Oh my god, it's Locke!" and she was like, "Oh my god!" And she's like, "He's the bad guy?" And it's like, "Oh yes,
so much so,
so much the bad guy." And he's really great in this. In fact, I would argue he is the reason to go back and watch this movie, because not only is his performance really fucking fantastic and really spot on and never over the top. There's one moment that isn't his fault. It's a fault in the writing and the direction, where it's just kind of like, that moment went just a little far.
But it's like this much too far.
Yeah,
it's just a hair.
It's just a hair too
oddly
far.
Oddly enough.
You know what I'm talking about. The moment in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's so fucking good in this. It's one of those movies that for performances alone, no matter what else is going on in the movie, no matter what weaknesses this movie has, he makes this infinitely watchable. It is just his performance is just so good. And he does, when he is being the the charming, you know, 1950s old fashioned dad. Yeah. He's really believable in that. And then when he starts losing his shit, especially in the times he's in his workshop, he's scary. And then they really kind of set him up to be smart. And then he is smart.
Yeah, he's
brilliant.
He
does smart things throughout the movie, throwing everybody off his scent, where you're just like, damn, this guy really is fucking ahead of everybody.
Yeah.
And it all works.
Yeah, and what I love so much about it is this performance is characterized by this slavish devotion to the American dream. Like, he is obsessed with the idea of the perfect family. He's obsessed with the idea of finding that perfect family, which would be charming if not for, again, that first scene where we see what happens when anything gets in the way of his pursuit of that perfect family. He will readily burn everything down and start again. And the way he does that is what's so violent and terrifying. Now, in addition to Terry O'Quinn, we have in this movie Jill Sholin, who, if you guys are familiar with her, I don't blame you. She had this really brief window of, like, she was in every horror film of, like, the late 80s, early 90s. Like, she shows up in Cutting Class, the Robert Englund Phantom of the Opera, in Popcorn, like, all of these sort of B, lesser-known, you know, horror films of the late 80s, early 90s. But she kind of, like, made that her own. Like,
and here she's playing a girl named Nipples McGee, who is always cold.
I don't think that's her name, but I understand.
Always cold, and no matter what she's wearing, is just poking out of everything.
Yeah, she's supposed to be 16, so what you're saying should be creepy, but it turns out she was well into her 20s when she was playing this role.
Well, no, that's actually the reason I brought that up, is this: she's supposed to be 16 years old, and she's not a sexual character, but this movie does a couple things to sexualize her in ways that feel a little off. Mm-hmm. And work thematically in what they're doing. I understand at, like, a higher level what they're trying to achieve and what they're trying to say thematically in this film. But it's also just very weird how you have this kind of pure, you know, rebellious, likable young character who then just spontaneously they keep trying to sexualize.
Well, it's she's a weird amalgam of, like, squeaky clean girl next door and total rebel. Because at different points in the movie, she's both.
Yeah.
At certain points in the movie, she's, like, fighting with another girl in class and then, like, disrespecting the teacher as he's dragging her out. And she gets expelled. And then in the next moment, she's just, like, this perfect little angel. And it's like, I can't get a bead on you. I can't figure out what you're all about.
Well, no, and that is one of the other elements that makes this work, that as far as Terry O'Quinn is a great antagonist, she is a really likable, understandable protagonist. She's a teenage girl who lost her father and is stuck with this evil stepdad. And it's very, you really connect with it. And then you have a non sequitur shower sequence.
Right.
Where it's really weird, mm-hmm. but it feels very 80s, like, oh shit, we totally showed a dude get into the shower, so we're going to frame the shot exactly the same way and show the 16-year-old girl get in the shower. And that was the moment where my wife was like, wait, I thought this character was 16, and I'm like, yeah, and she's like, that's creepy, and I'm like, yeah, just kind of go with it, because she's still kind of adorable.
Yeah.
At which point I got an ugly look from my wife.
And yeah, that was a silly thing to say.
Yeah, that was a very silly thing to say. But I say silly things occasionally that get me in trouble. But it's a weird choice in that they decide to do that to a 16-year-old character. It's something you couldn't get away with today.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 80s, you know, you could, you know, they did this kind of stuff. But it was very weird in the fact that they had her go obviously braless for most of the movie, standing out in the cold. It was like, this feels like a choice and not something that just happened.
Yeah.
And so that's why I made the joke as the way I did, because it's a weird choice that feels like it may have been an interesting thematic choice. Trying to, you know, this is the problem that he's having with her. I don't even know what to call him because he has so many names even in the film.
I just go with Jerry Blake.
Jerry Blake, because that's the name he chose for this particular household.
And that's why I love the tagline of this movie, and a line that comes up later is, he says,
who am I here?
Yeah.
because he has a different identity. He's a completely different person in every new homestead that he sets up. And I want to say something else, too. You mentioned that she has an evil stepdad, which is true because of the information they've given us in the beginning of the movie. And yet they slow roll that shit in such a great way.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's not just the instant he gets in that house. He's not abusive to the mom. He's not like enforcing all these rules, but because she's rebellious inherently when he gets there, it would have been so easy for the conflict to have been, I'm rebellious, you're a straight-laced dad, and you impose all these rules upon me. But he's not like that. He's the nicest fucking stepdad at the beginning of the movie that you could possibly hope for.
It's and like, hey, you know, we seem to have a hard time connecting. Here's a puppy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I got expelled from school. Okay, well, let's figure out what we're going to do in the future. Yeah. Like, even moments where it'd be completely reasonable for any dad or stepdad to blow his stack, he's very even keel. They keep that, he plays it so close to the vest, and they just slowly let little bits of his madness leak out. And the way they dole it out is so expertly done and really makes the movie very tense, because we know what he's capable of and we know that he's evil, but we also know that he has to keep up this veneer, that he has to keep up this mask of sanity in order to make this work, because through it all, he wants to make it work. He's willing to deny, like, and willing to suppress everything that's wrong with him, everything that makes him completely insane, because all he wants is the perfect family. So you see him desperately trying to keep all this stuff bottled up, which I think is what keeps this from feeling like a run-of-the-mill slasher film. Because he's not just...
Well, it's... Yeah, no, even comparing it to a run-of-the-mill slasher film, because it's not really a slasher film.
Yeah, I mean, when the director took this on, this guy named Joseph Rubin, who, by the way, has directed movies like Dreamscape, True Believers, Sleeping with the Enemy, and most recently The Forgotten with Julianne Moore. Like, this is a guy who's been working for a long time and doing things that you recognize. When he took on the project, they basically pitched it to him as a slasher film, and he's like, I don't want to make just a regular slasher film. So Jerry Blake is not a kill-em-all, bloodthirsty Jason Voorhees type. Like I said, he's a simmering psycho who kills out of desperation, you know, as he clings to each new life that he's created for himself. When things start to get in the way of what he sees as the ideal of the utopic American family, that's when shit snaps in his brain. And that's when he goes off. And we know he's capable of that. So what we're sitting there watching is like a coiled rattlesnake. We're just like real tense. We're on the edge of our seat waiting for that moment when he's going to strike, because we don't know, because the movie does such a good job of not making it easy for us to know. Yeah. And I really like that about it. And I think that's one of the things that's also allowed it to hold up, because I watch this movie probably once a year, and I keep finding that the only thing that really dates the movie for me is the music. Everything else about this movie feels like you could have made it yesterday and it would still work.
Yeah, the music is one of the rough points in the
movie. It's in that weird period where, you know, in the late 80s, synthesizer music took on a really ugly new face.
Yeah.
Synthesizer music in the early 80s was, the difference is really easy to define. In the early 80s, synthesizers were used, but they were like, you never tried to force a synthesizer to sound like a real instrument. You allowed the synthesizer to have its own unique sound. Yes. And sound otherworldly.
And it was otherworldly or cutting edge.
Cutting edge, and atmospheric, yeah.
And it's one of those things that works for a lot of movies and doesn't work for others.
Sure.
Like, you know, you have movies like Lady Hawk where it's like, shit, this movie's so good, but the score is so out of fucking
place.
Yeah,
it's not a perfect fix. It's not for every movie, but when it's used well, it's like it doesn't matter that you don't have a real orchestra. The synthesizer works just fine. Look at the Tangerine Dream score for Thief, for Sorcerer.
Look at just the Tangerine Dream score, dot, dot, dot.
There you go.
Yeah.
But in the late 80s, somebody, some fucking idiot I would love to punch in the dick, decided we need to make the keyboard sound like real instruments. So when you push this button, it sounds like trumpets. And when you push this button, it sounds like violins. And I'm just like, no. Because it doesn't. It doesn't at all sound like real instruments. And yet you're trying to force it. Like, oh, this is a real score. And this is what they refer to a lot of times as score in a box.
Yeah.
When you hear that, you hear it a lot in the Full Moon movies. Charles Band used this shit all the time. And it's one of the things that really drives me crazy about the Full Moon movies, which were largely the biggest ones made in the late 80s. So in this movie, you have a little bit of that, but then you also have music that at times just doesn't quite fit the moment. Like, it's not even about the orchestration. Like, it's not just about the fact that you have fake instruments on a keyboard, the score in a box. It's just that you have this music that's like, okay, this doesn't really fit what's going on. It doesn't really, like, gel with the tone of the scene. So I think, but outside of the score, I think everything else about this movie, you could watch it 10 years from now. It'll be as effective as it is today, as effective as it was in 1987. And unfortunately, somebody thought, well, then we should remake it. And that happened. They remade it with...
Well, we're not going to end up covering a movie that hasn't been remade when
that's
we're talking
true.
About slasher films, because there isn't a recognizable slasher film that hasn't been remade.
Dylan Walsh, who's great on Nip Tuck, helms one of the absolute worst horror remakes, you know, of the past 10 years or so.
And I think that's arguable because there's so many really, truly bad ones.
It may not be yes. the worst, but it's definitely yes. one of the worst.
Well, because, you know, Sorority.
House on Sorority Row.
Oh, wow. I actually dropped a bomb on you that made
fucking hate
throb.
That movie. So, you know what?
Oh, my God.
You know what I think is going to be the death knell? I really believe this of the horror remakes. Is when The Town That Dreaded Sundown comes out.
It's out.
Yeah, I thought it didn't come out till January. I mean, we saw it at Fantastic Fest. But
no. I think it's already been released.
Oh, okay. Well, there
I
you
thought
go.
So.
Well, that's how bad it is. If you didn't see it and you didn't hear about it, well.
It is January. I thought it already come out.
It's fucking terrible. And it tries to go meta with it, and it still fails miserably in a way that's like, okay, you're making me not even want to watch the original anymore. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Because
we're talking about the original Stepfather.
We are.
Can we talk about the worst part of the Stepfather, though?
What is the worst part of the Stepfather?
The exposition and gun delivery device known as a Ken Wall clone.
I fucking love that. Because, okay, here's what... Okay, so throughout the movie...
There is a guy who was cloned from the DNA of Ken Wall.
That is entirely true. I'm not going to argue that. You're a wise guy. I'm not going to argue with you on that. Hey-o. People are like, what the fuck does that joke mean? Don't worry about it.
People from the 80s got it.
So there's this detective.
That just lays really well.
He's not even a detective. He's like an investigative journalist.
No. There's an investigative journalist, but that's not the character we're talking about.
Oh, wait, which one are you talking about?
We're talking about, okay, so randomly, out of nowhere, these two characters roll up, and you assume they're in a Pontiac. They must be cops. They're not cops. One is a portly, overweight guy who works for the Seattle Examiner, who is a investigative reporter. The other is the brother of the victim.
Oh, okay.
Who has been, as he explains in some very clunky exposition, kicking around Europe for a while, and it took 9 months to find out that his sister and daughter and niece were killed. And so now he's back to find this guy, and he's like on the case, and he really only exists to add little pieces of exposition every 15 to 20 minutes and then deliver a gun to our characters at the end of the movie.
But here's why I like that. Because in any other fucking movie like this, this would be the guy in quote-unquote story B who shows up at the end of the movie just in time to save the day. Who's like the guy who kicks down the door right as he's about to stab Jill Schoen and pumps it through like full of nine bullets. This movie's like, no, fuck that guy.
That guy only exists to get shot so that he can reach into his pocket and go, here, I brought a gun for your family. Oh,
he runs in there like the timing on it is so good because they time it to the moment where he would normally show up in a regular movie like this, and yet he's immediately fucking killed. Yeah. By Terry
We've actually watched him train with the gun that he will never use.
No, and Terry Quinn tears through him like tissue paper, and he's just fucking dead immediately.
Hey, did I mention I have a knife?
But here's why I think that really works. Is because I would kind of be offended if throughout the whole movie, Jill Schoen is like, once she figures this guy out, she's like, no, I don't buy your bullshit. I'm totally against you. I'm totally going to bring you down. If at the end of the movie, some random dude kicks in the door and kills him for her, it wouldn't work. In my opinion, it would not work as well.
I agree, but that is, yeah. But the thing is they definitely, the director really knew what he was doing. He's like, I'm going to set this up. Everybody's going to see this coming. And then I'm going to left turn. I'm going to zig when they think I'm going to zag. And we're going to kill that guy. And really, he only exists for exposition and gun delivery.
Right.
At the same time, He only exists for exposition and cut delivery.
But I love that moment so much because it's like, you know, like the first time you see it, you know, you think you know where it's going so much. Like, oh my God, they're going to do this thing. And then he just fucking kills him. It's like, oh.
And the look on his face mimics the look on the audience's face where they're like, oh, hey, they just killed it. Oh.
Oh, shit.
Oh, no. It's totally not going to happen.
Yeah.
But then the movie just ends up doing the flip,
mm-hmm.
and in doing that flip, gives that role to another character.
Which happens to be Jill Sholin, which I think is cool because it
No, because Jill Sholin's the young girl, correct?
Yeah, Jill Sholin, yeah.
Yeah, no, because she's not the one that ends up really...
No, but she is the one that, like, because Mom's knocked out of commission. Shelley Hack plays the mother.
Yeah.
Mom's knocked out of commission early on in this, and when the curtain is pulled back, and when he has that great moment where he says, you know, he realizes he said the wrong name, she's caught him in a lie, and he has that great moment where everything unravels and he says, who am I here? He knocks her out with the phone immediately after saying that.
Yeah, like he pulls a Fred the Hammer Williamson pimp move, just like,
yeah.
Oh, hey, there's a call for you.
Bam. Yeah. Oh, look, it was a three-way call. Bam, bam. But yeah, so she's out of commission pretty early on, and the rest of that climax is Jill Sholin, by the way, doing all of her own stunts. And it's a really actually exciting scene, but she's the one doing all the fucking work. Like, Mom's the one that ends up going, oh, thank you, gun delivery system. I will take the shot, but...
Bam, bam! And of course, one of the things I really like about what they did is, you know, they really illustrated that this guy went to work and really trained with his gun that he's never going to use. Mom hasn't trained for shit and can't hit for shit.
Yeah.
And the places he gets shot are usually places they don't shoot bad guys in movies and is really interesting.
Yeah.
And makes for a really good, tense final scene that as much as there's wonkiness and, mm-hmm. and a lot of simplicity to what they're doing, it's all really effective and it really works. And there's a messiness to it that feels real.
Yeah.
You know, that feels like it's not, it doesn't feel contrived.
Right.
It's one of those things that when you look at it structurally, yeah, no, he's an exposition gun delivery system, but you know, stepping outside of this, you know, breaking down the structure, it is a guy who showed up and he's like, I'm going to get revenge. And then he's like, oh fuck, this is the guy. What do I, oh, this guy already thought ahead of me. And while I was busy thinking how I'm going to savor, you know, killing the guy who killed my sister, he totally put a fucking knife in me and maybe I could shoot him with this gun. Oh, bonk, no, bonk. I can't. And then Mom is like, oh, now I can shoot Terry O'Quinn with the gun. And it's like, oh, hey, by the way, I can't shoot for shit.
As it turns out, I've never fired a gun in my life and I'm not especially good at it. So here we go. But here's the thing about the stepfather that I think is interesting is that it's less like the other horror films of its era. And I would put this, if I were to do a triple feature, if I were to pick two other movies to watch immediately after The Stepfather, one of them would be Night of the Hunter with Robert Mitchum.
The other would be The Cutting Edge, also starring Terry O'Quinn.
No, the other would not be The Cutting Edge, starring Terry O'Quinn, nor would it be Pin, starring Terry O'Quinn. It would be... So Night of the Hunter, if you haven't seen it, is this 1950s movie where Robert Mitchum plays a Bluebeard.
Why have we not covered Night of the Hunter?
We probably will at some point.
We need to cover Night of the Hunter.
We probably... And everyone listening, take a drink for every time we talk about a movie we will cover.
Let me just jump in here and say that Night of the Hunter is one of those... It is an older black and white film, and we often don't go back into the black and white era. But it is one of those essential films. It's one of those films... It's so good. It is directed by one of the people who's considered one of the only perfect directors ever, Charles Laughton, mm-hmm. who directed this. It got terrible reviews. It bombed at the box office. He decided never to direct again. And it wasn't until years later that it was re-examined. Everyone went, oh my God, this movie's fucking brilliant and was ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit. And now to this day, we sit there and go, dude, this fucking movie's fucking perfect.
Yeah, and it's got a great Criterion Blu-ray out, by the way, which you should totally seek out. It's one of my favorite movies, starring one of my favorite actors, Robert Mitchum, who plays a Bluebeard, who is a guy who is essentially, like, he goes around and does exactly what Terry O'Quinn does in this movie. He goes around, he marries young widows, and becomes the head of the family, and then immediately it's clear something's wrong. He murders them for their money. But anyway, so I would the killer that Terry O'Quinn is playing is more akin to Robert Mitchum in Night of the Hunter than it is any, you know, typical slasher or, you know, horror film killer of this era. And then the other film I would highly recommend, I don't know how much I really like have lost all track of how much this movie still is in the consciousness of people, but The Talented Mr. Ripley, with Matt Damon, but from the late 90s, which is a movie about a guy who keeps adopting other personas. And anytime anyone gets in the way of this life that he's kind of building for himself as this persona, he lashes out violently. And he's kind of the last person you would expect to be violent. He's like this kind of nebbish little guy. But it very much reminds me of there's a scene where Jill Sholin's character, her psychiatrist, is basically trying to get information. Like, Jill has revealed to him her suspicions about her new stepdad. So he pretends to be Terry O'Quinn's working as a real estate agent. So the psychiatrist pretends to be a potential buyer and is like asking these really kind of prodding questions, trying to provoke him into seeing what he'll do. And of course it leads to this guy's fucking demise.
Well, because this guy's a really bad liar.
He's terrible at it. But it's one of those moments where when Terry O'Quinn lashes out, my favorite part of that scene is that the first blow doesn't knock the guy down. Because like, the fuck are you doing? And he keeps hitting him until he finally takes it. Like, it reminds me of it's not by any means my favorite Hitchcock movie, but there's a movie called Torn Curtain, where Paul Newman and a woman he's conspiring with are trying to kill this agent, and everything that they try goes wrong. Like, they stab him, the knife breaks. They try to stick his head in the oven, they can't get the gas to turn on. They try to strangle him, nothing works. And it kind of shows you how messy the actual act of murder really is. And that's what that scene reminds me of, because he keeps hitting him with the board. He's like, stop that, what are you doing? What's going on? And it takes him forever to actually bring the guy down. But yeah, I would say Night of the Hunter and The Talented Mr. Ripley would actually make a nice little, like a sandwich. Like, if you wanted to sandwich those three movies together, I think with The Stepfather would make a very interesting evening, if nothing else. But yeah, The Stepfather is one of the really great movies, one of the really great, I think, underappreciated horror films of the late 80s. And if you haven't gotten a chance to see it, there's a great Shout Factory Blu-ray that is all cleaned up and it looks great. There's some great special features on it. I think it's one of the first Blu-rays that made me go, oh, Shout Factory's got some cool stuff. It was many years ago. But that was before they even launched their Scream Factory wing with all the horror stuff. So really cool. You should definitely check it out. By the way, the script for this movie, we haven't talked about the script for this movie.
We have not.
It was written by Donald Westlake. It was written by the guy who's the creator of Parker, who his name has been changed, but he's the literary character who appears in movies like Payback, Point Blank, The Outfit. You know, is that not so great Jason Statham movie last year where they actually used the character's name for the first time instead of changing it to Harker or Harper or whatever. So Donald Westlake writes this script that he actually bases on his relationship with his own stepdaughter. Apparently they weren't getting along at the time. So he writes the Jill Sholin character kind of based on the girl. And then the Terry O'Quinn character is based on a real murder case. It's based on John List, who was a New Jersey man who killed his family in 71, was on the run till 1989, and actually was captured thanks to the show America's Most Wanted.
Yeah.
So
I remember when that happened. Yeah. He had set up a whole other family.
Yeah, exactly. He was living this whole entire other life as a ruse or a shield against what he had done to his previous family. Also, another nod to the greatness of Terry O'Quinn's performance here is that Jill Sholin claimed that she was so disturbed from filming this third act with him that she had recurring nightmares for a week about being chased by him. And they occurred as sort of a reenactment of that exact scene. So you got to give it up to Terry O'Quinn for his ability to create nightmares, not only in the audience, but in his co-stars as well. He's just that good.
Yeah, he really is one of those underappreciated actors. It makes me wonder why he hasn't gotten more work. Because he's really so effective in everything he does. Like, you know, regardless of what the genre is, he always fucking brings it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that was the thing that really, because I hadn't seen it in a very long time. It was another one of those, like I'd mentioned before with My Bloody Valentine, that I'd seen back in the 80s but hadn't felt the need to revisit. And you're like, we need to talk about this one because I love this movie. And it's like, well, shit, let me sit down and rewatch it. And it's like, god damn it, I forgot how good Terry O'Quinn is in this movie. Like, he's just so goddamn good. Mm-hmm. And when he's being schmaltzy, it's wonderfully schmaltzy, and he knows how to break up that schmaltz and make it feel authentic. But when he's being creepy, dear God, is that motherfucker creepy?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to take a quick sojourn down the road of unnecessary sequels, because The Stepfather isn't just a film, it's a franchise.
It's a franchise.
And I'm not just talking about original remake. There were two sequels. Yes. There were two sequels made. One of them was made in 1989, and it brings back Terry O'Quinn, who has survived the events of the first film and is in an asylum, which he escapes from, and immediately goes and does the exact same thing again, where he saddles up to a widow and her child, in this case, his son, and they move into a new town under he's under a different name, and, you know, just trying once again to set up the perfect family. And when the cracks in the veneer happen, or when people get too close, that's when the murdering happens all over again. But the thing about the second one that is most notable is that the woman he marries is played by Meg Foster. Meg Foster, who was sort of a staple of the 80s. She's the woman with the just piercing blue eyes, like Daniel Craig blue eyes. And she was in movies like Masters of the Universe. She was in They Live. She appears in movies all throughout the 80s. So it's actually, in my opinion, it's not terrible. It just doesn't have any of the real effect of the first one, because much like a lot of sequels, it's doing a lot of the same things right over again. Like, it's retracing its steps in a way that just feels kind of repetitive. But, you know, the way it's executed is not terrible. That cannot be said, however, of Stepfather 3, which had Terry O'Quinn. It was released in 92, direct-to-video. And it was the movie that made Terry O'Quinn go, you know what? I don't want to come back to this. I'm okay not doing this anymore. So they hire a guy named Robert Whiteman. And it's like, well, wait a minute, hold on. We've developed this franchise with Terry O'Quinn. This guy looks completely different. How are we going to explain that? Well,
plastic surgery.
Plastic fucking surgery. So he's once again back in the asylum, because it's again, it's just like, hit the reset button. So he's back in the asylum. He escapes again, finds this back alley plastic surgeon a la the Joker in Tim Burton's Batman. And he has him do this like whole reconstructive surgery. And then he kills the plastic surgeon, and he looks like this completely different actor. And the weird thing about this one is that the family, the woman he sides up with, is her son is in a wheelchair. And he keeps trying to convince the kid that, like, his injuries are psychosomatic and he needs to get the fuck up out of the wheelchair. So most of the rage that he has in the movie is that, like, he can't have a perfect family because his son is crippled. And it's just like, that's really, like...
You kind of could have picked another woman. You didn't have to...
Yeah, it's like, but then just leave her alone. Like, if you have such a problem with it, just, like, move on to a different family. And at the end of the movie, he falls into a wood chipper. So it's, like, the definitive end of this character. And... what I find interesting is that we talked last week about My Bloody Valentine, which is a movie that the MPAA really came down hard on and made them cut their death scenes. They were like, we're just going to get an X rating and this is too violent. And the second movie, Stepfather 2, the Weinsteins saw the movie and went, there's not enough blood in this. So they wanted them to go back and reshoot a lot of these scenes to add more violence, but neither Terry O'Quinn nor the director wanted anything to do with that. So they actually hired a second director to come in and film just more violent versions of the scenes that they already had. So it's a very bizarre kind of lineage of sequels and, like, then direct-to-video sequels. And it's just, you can kind of understand why they remade it, if not for the greatness of the first one, but by probably how cheap it was to get the rights at that point. Later on. But yeah, that's kind of the breakdown of the sequels of The Stepfather, which, if you have any interest in seeing, you're only going to be able to pick up on VHS. I can almost assure you that, because I had to go diving at the local video store here in Austin, I Love Video, to find this stuff on VHS. So it's not especially easy to get your hands on.
And there's a reason why it's not easy. Sometimes it's like, damn it, this neglected gem has been rotting on a shelf somewhere, and we must have a DVD. These are not those.
These are not those. Sorry, Meg Foster, but these are not those. And before we go to the junk food pairing, I just want to share a quick story. I was at Comic-Con a few years ago, and I was walking to the end of the massive Leviathan Hall H line, which was, at that point, like, by the ocean. And I'm walking across the sidewalk, and all of a sudden they stop everybody going in both directions, and there's a big black SUV parked right next to me. I'm like, oh, somebody's being, like, shipped out of here. Like, somebody famous, somebody important, whatever. And coming out of this, like, this tinted gazebo area is Terry O'Quinn. And I was so excited because I'm such a big fan of the guy. But all I could think to say as he's walking by, because there's all these people around, so I just kind of yelled out, I love The Stepfather! And he stops, and he turns around, and he goes, wow, that's an old one. And then he gets in his car and drives away. And I was just like, yes, it is, but it's still great, and so are you. Like, it was just one of those moments where he was like, really? The Stepfather? Like, not Lost?
Did you not see Lost? You realize that I did that for, like, 6 years?
He's like, nope, I'm sorry, dude. Stepfather, all the way. Maybe Howard Hughes in The Rocketeer. We can talk about that later.
Maybe Howard. Dude, The Rocketeer.
It's amazing. It's a great film. But I still think The Stepfather is my favorite Terry O'Quinn movie. Of all the great Terry O'Quinn performances, this one is probably my favorite.
I think it may well be his best performance,
mm-hmm.
but it's not my favorite.
What's your favorite Terry O'Quinn?
Dude, I already dropped it this episode.
What? No, now I forget. You're going to have to...
It's Cutting Edge.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
We'll talk about Cutting Edge eventually and my sick love for Cutting Edge.
Oh, boy.
And all seven of the montages in the first 45 minutes.
Wait, so is Cutting Edge like Rocky IV, where all the other Rocky movies are a boxing film occasionally interrupted by a montage, but Rocky IV is a montage occasionally interrupted by a boxing movie?
Have you never seen The Cutting Edge?
No, I haven't seen The Cutting Edge.
Oh, we're doing a Cutting Edge episode. I'll get you hooked with the Terry O'Quinn. And
you know what adjective I would use to describe that upcoming episode? Not Cutting Edge.
You know what? I will tell you that by the end you will be madly in love with Moira Kelly. Because Moira Kelly in The Cutting Edge is kind of what it feels like to be in the 90s. It's just
she is the 90s.
It is just pure. It's like, she is toe pick, you know. But you know, some of you out there are going, yes, fuck yes, and the rest of you are like, what the fuck are you talking about? We'll get to that. So take your drink because we're talking about a future episode. But that's a Terry. That's my favorite movie that has Terry O'Quinn.
Junk Food Cinema, Days of Future Episodes.
Father knows best.
And now with this week's junk food pairing, here's Mr. Cargill.
The drumstick.
Why the drumstick?
The ice cream drumstick.
Oh, yes.
The delicious 35-cent treat that you got from the ice cream truck as it poured through your neighborhood. And I mention this because it brings together two important food scenes in this movie.
Okay, I'm listening.
One of them, of course, is the scene where, you know, Nipples McGinty.
Nipples McGinty.
ends up seeing, you know, Terry O'Quinn for the first time, losing his shit down in his workshop as she's going to get ice cream for the big party. And the other is when Terry O'Quinn learns the meaning of Thanksgiving for the first time in his life.
Aww.
When he discovers that his stepdaughter is a two drumstick kind of girl.
Which is a weird scene in the movie because, again, it's like I said before, she's an amalgam of the perfect sweet girl next door and a teenage rebel.
Yeah.
And we've just seen her be a complete teenage rebel, and then at the Thanksgiving she's just like, I want two drumsticks. I'm like, you can't do that. You can't be like sweet, squeaky, clean, cute girl right after you like beat some other girl's ass.
Yeah.
But she does it. She pulls it off because she's a two drumstick girl.
She does. And there's
one drumstick for each personality.
And really the thing is, you know, the thing that really kind of sells this for me is the drumstick kind of nails home what the stepfather is. You know, on the outside, it seems to be the all-American treat.
True.
And on the inside, it's artificial flavoring and none of it's really real.
But it still tastes really good.
It's still delicious.
It's still so tasty.
I mean, I'm not saying I wouldn't devour a box of drumsticks right now.
I'm really glad that's where you went with that, because we were just talking about Tits McGinty. And then he
Nipples
said,
McGinty.
Nipples McGinty. And then he's like, I'm not saying I wouldn't. I was like, uh-oh. Abort.
No, wave off. Yeah, I'm the jet in Hunt for an October. Wave off. But like 12 of you got that, and I love all 12 of you.
There you go.
But no, not saying I wouldn't devour a box of drumsticks right now. But you know they're not good for you.
No, of course not. Of course they're not.
And neither is the stepfather. Hey-o. And thus, that's our junk food pairing for the week.
Delicious. Well, that does it for this week's show, guys. Thank you so much for joining us as we continue our bloody trail across the calendar year. I want to remind you yet again that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or you can, of course, like the web or the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. Cargill, where can people find you, on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, or on facebook.com/Massaworm.
Right on. You can find me on Twitter at Bryguy Salisbury. That's SalisBury, just like, that's right, the steak. And you can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. Or please do check out my home away from home, oneofus.net. Lots of podcasts and blogs for whatever your fandom is. Check that out. And please, please, please do use those Amazon links. If you decide that you want to buy either The Stepfather or anything from Amazon, you're going to do some holiday shopping, come here first, use that link, get to Amazon, then whatever you buy, that benefits us. And we really do appreciate it. But for Cargill, this is Brian signing off, reminding you that when Father's Day rolls around, make sure to buy a gift for your stepfather. Because you know what? Stepfathers are people too. Crazy people who will slaughter your whole family if you step out of line.